I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump has spent the last few days undoing his predecessor's policies and plans, the Affordable Care Act, TPP, the abortion global gag rule, Keystone XL pipeline, and regulations. Here's what he said while meeting with a group of business leaders on Monday.
We think we can cut regulations by 75%, maybe more, but by 75%, have, in a certain way, better protections. But when you want to expand your plant, or when Mark wants to come in and build a big, massive plant, or when Dell wants to come in and do something monstrous and special, you're going to have your approvals really fast.
Trump tweeted that today is a big day for national security and is expected to order the start of the construction of the wall along the Mexican border, reduce the number of refugees who can live in the United States, and block refugees from what he calls terror-prone countries from entering the country at all. As of this week, EPA and other agencies are now under a gag order. President Trump continues to say that illegal voting prevented him from winning the popular vote, a claim that has been discredited. And this morning, he tweeted that he'll be asking for a major investigation into voter fraud. Joining us is Edward Isaac Devere, chief Washington correspondent for Politico. And Isaac, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
Also with us is Ross Baker, distinguished professor of political science at Rutgers University School of Arts and Sciences, author of several books, including most recently, Is Bipartisanship Dead? And Ross Baker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be on again, Marty.
Let me start with you, Isaac, if I could. And I'm trying to remember 8 years ago to then President Obama's first week in office. How does Trump's first couple of days compare to Obama's?
Well, look, we see a lot of executive actions being taken. What is different from the beginning of the Obama days is that there was not as quite as much of an emphasis on executive actions in the early days of the presidency, though we did see very quickly when Obama came in, if you remember, he had that meeting about closing Guantanamo Bay and that was going to be a big priority of his administration. As we know, he left office last week without having closed Guantanamo Bay. But executive actions, which are things that the president can order be done simply by the stroke of a pen, are things that became a very big theme of Barack Obama's presidency through the final 2 years, essentially. It seems like what we have from President Trump so far is an emphasis on those sorts of things. However, importantly, much of what he has signed so far is symbolic. He didn't withdraw the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The United States was never in the Trans-Pacific Partnership,
exactly.
the trade deal. Right? There were negotiations that the United States had been part of, and we'd gotten to a point last year when those negotiations were concluded, there was a vote that could have come before Congress to ratify that treaty. It did not happen, obviously. In fact, it would have not been a treaty ratifying. It would have been through this trade legislation that would have fast-tracked it, so that they didn't have to go through every piece of the trade deal. But we never entered it, and in fact, because of Trump's election, the leaders in Congress, Paul Ryan, the Speaker, said there was not going to be a move on it, and it was declared dead already. So what the executive action on the TPP did from President Trump was to say, we're not going to continue any negotiations on a trade deal that's already dead.
I hear that. You know what, Isaac, hold on, because I want to get Ross Baker in on the conversation. And Ross, all presidents, or most every president, certainly in modern history, has used executive orders. And as Isaac said, President Obama used it to try to close Gitmo, which, of course, did not happen. Are there checks on what an executive order or what an executive can do when they issue that order?
Well, I suppose the ultimate check on an executive order is that if the executive order costs money, the president's got to go to Congress and get an appropriation. And Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution is pretty emphatic on that. So executive orders can certainly, for example, protect a wilderness area or convert a federal reserve to a national park. And many of these things, you know, can be reversed. But mostly, as Edward pointed out, these tended to be used by President Obama in the latter stages of his second term, largely because Congress had been so unobliging to do the things he wanted to do. I mean, for example, on both the deferred action on childhood arrivals and deferred action on parental arrivals, they were issued largely because President could not get a more comprehensive immigration reform.
And, of course, what happens with those executive orders when the next president comes in, it's kind of a clean slate, Ross, and they can undo or start all over again.
That's correct. There are so many of them, of course, the new president may have trouble keeping track of them all. And, you know, there are many things that the presidents can do unilaterally because of the unique situation the American president has, as opposed to the parliamentary systems in Europe, for example, because the president is both the head of state and the head of government. And the head of state part of the job really involves the kind of the traditional role of issuing proclamations and executive orders. So, but if the president wants something to be lasting and unassailable, he really has to go to Congress and get a statutory basis for it.
Well, Isaac, let me go back to you. And as we all know, building the wall along the Mexican border, that was a rallying cry for President Trump and his supporters. Now, apparently he's going to, or perhaps already has, issued, I guess, the order to start construction, but that will cost money. He has to go through Congress, yes?
Yes, unless he wants to somehow do it based on all volunteer work and
or get Mexico to pay for it, right?
No, even if unless Mexico is going to show up with the Mexican president comes with a giant suitcase full of money. We have some dispute between the president and Congress about how exactly this will be paid for. There is a provision in a bill from a law from about 10 years ago that would allow some funding to be directed toward building the wall. That would be American taxpayer money. Trump has since Congress started focusing on that a couple of weeks ago, said that that's wrong to think that Americans will be paying for the wall. We'll just be paying for it up front, and that he would then exact payment from Mexico via tariffs or other things that are unclear. That also would require congressional action. So it's one thing to say we're going to start building the wall, or even what we know is going to be in one of these executive orders today, that there should be 5,000 more border agents. Right. It's another thing to say who's going to pay for the wall, who's going to pay for the salaries and equipment for those border agents.
Well, Isaac, is there appetite, you think, in Congress to come up with what has to be billions of dollars in order to come true on this campaign promise?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Isaac, and then to you, Ross.
Sorry, I don't know that we know the answer to that yet. This is the Republicans in Congress are tend to, at least in years past, be very cautious and resistant to any new government expenditures. This would be a massive government expenditure for each one of these pieces. Yet they also are saying that they want to support President Trump's agenda as much as they can.
What do you think, Ross?
Well, I was just thinking that perhaps the president might take the same approach on the wall that he's proposed on this trillion-dollar infrastructure, which is to get the private sector to invest in it, and then you can charge tolls. But clearly, there has been an appropriation, as was pointed out, but the money's got to come from somewhere.
Right.
The House Republican Conference is dominated by people who are extremely deficit averse. And I think, you know, it's the kind of thing I think that's likely to create tensions, if not outright conflict, between the Trump administration and his own party in Congress.
Ross, there's so much to talk about, and it's only been a couple of days. But what do you make of these gag orders? And I was listening to a report from NPR and locally here at WHYY, which is not entirely unusual to have at least some kind of a pause when a new president comes in before agencies begin to, I guess, release press releases or to get everyone sort of on the same page. Is there something unusual that President Trump is asking these agencies to do or not do?
Well, unusual and a little bit sinister, I think. And that is that from what I've heard, they seem to be pretty well targeted on agencies that do a lot of scientific research, like NOAA, or agencies that are doing work on climate change, environmental issues, and so on. So, I mean, I don't think that this is necessarily aimed at the Pentagon or the Treasury Department, but it seems to me to be aimed at those agencies that are problematic in the eyes of the president.
Do you see it that way, Isaac?
Well, I would know that these are agencies that where there are going to be big changes, really sharp turns, right? The EPA, you have in Scott Pruitt, if he's confirmed as the EPA administrator, someone who does not believe in a lot of the work that the Environmental Protection Agency has been doing in regulating emissions and all sorts of other things over the last bunch of years, especially under Barack Obama. At the Health and Human Services, where there's another one of these gag orders that seems to be in place, obviously you have in Tom Price, if he's confirmed as secretary or whoever might be confirmed as secretary, what will be a sharp turn if President Trump gets his way away from Obamacare. It's also an issue of just how much change is potentially going through here. Notably, you had at the EPA during the transition, there was a questionnaire that went out from the Trump transition that asked for people who had been involved with some of the big things on some of the environmental moves that Barack Obama had been doing to identify those staffers, it seemed like, which made a lot of people at the EPA quite nervous that they were going to be facing repercussions. Here's another thing that could make them face repercussions if they try to go public with any of the things that are going on in their agency.
Well, we're almost having a break here. Isaac, does it affect your work? Because it sounds like they're not allowed. I don't know if they'll agree or obey that, but not allowed to talk to the press.
Well, as a journalist,
without giving away secrets, yes. No, go ahead.
I'm always in favor of open and transparent government. I do believe that it makes our government stronger, no matter what it is that the government is doing. It's obviously more difficult if you can't call up a government agency and say, "Hi, what is the answer to this question about what you're doing?" If they can't answer it because they're banned from it, I do think that that doesn't mean that no information will come out. These are all human beings.
Sure.
Working at these agencies, and I think we're likely to see a lot more leaks going on. But an administration which may be trying to prosecute people who leak.
Well, I do want to pick up on that and a whole bunch of things. Talking with Edward Isaac Dovier, chief Washington correspondent for Politico, and Ross Baker from Rutgers University. Talking about the first few days of the Trump administration. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we're talking about what President Trump has done thus far as commander-in-chief. Edward Isaac Dovier joining us, chief Washington correspondent for Politico. Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University School of Arts and Sciences. He's written a bunch of books, including Is Bipartisanship Dead? He's also worked with Democrats, in fact, for a while, was embedded in the office of former House Speaker Harry Reid. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do you want the president to do? What do you fear that he might do? Ross, where does this leave the Democrats? Of course, they're the minority party certainly the two branches of government. What kind of tools do they have that they can use to, if not get their agenda passed, at least make problems for the president and the Republicans?
I think their options are very limited. In the House of Representatives, they are greatly outnumbered. In the Senate, although the numbers are close, they're also deceptive. In past years, prior to 2013, the filibuster could be used on virtually anything, either legislation or nominations. In 2013, Majority Leader Reid invoked the so-called nuclear option, which restricted the filibuster basically to Supreme Court nominees.
Right.
And so the kind of opposition that in past years could have been mounted and actually have defeated or caused to withdraw a president's nominees basically has been lost to the Democrats. I mean, they're certainly questioning the nominees very vigorously in the committees, but I think that nobody would bet anything on the fact that even if he was one of these nominees would be either forced to withdraw or be defeated on a floor vote.
Isaac, it seems as if President Trump is obsessed about the results of the election and the fact that based on, I think, every reputable analysis and organization is that he did lose the popular vote by less than 3 million, but nonetheless, I think, a fairly sizable amount in today's world of elections. And he is going to look into some kind of or have some kind of investigation into voter fraud. That was done here in Pennsylvania. It's been done in a lot of other states as well. What do you think is going on with President Trump?
This is
the day that
Go ahead. Hold on, Ross, and we'll get Isaac, and then we'll go back to you.
Since the day that he won on November 8th, which was a surprise to him, he did not expect to win. He had been saying that he was expecting to lose. He has not been able to go through almost any conversation in public or private without making some reference to his win. He did it as he was talking to people through the transition, even when they were coming in for he did it in a conversation, private conversation with union leaders. I know at one point during in December that was had nothing to do with the campaign at all. We saw it in public as he did that thank you tour. We saw it in his first speech after his inaugural address as president when he went to the CIA headquarters on Saturday and spent most of his time standing in front of the wall of the memorial stars of killed intelligence officers, talking about how big his win was and how big his crowds were. This is he wants to keep talking about this. He is clearly to the point of obsessed with it. And the fact that Hillary Clinton beat him by 2.8 million votes in the popular vote is another part of the what may be fairly called an obsession here. And so now he is continuing to insist, and it's not the first time that he's done it this week, but he did it again as his first time, I think, as president, two congressional leaders at the White House on Monday. Thinks that there is he believes that there's some evidence that there were 3 to 5 million illegal votes, which, by the way, would be conveniently just the right and the right amount of number to put him ahead in the popular vote. There is no evidence of it. Beyond that, there being no evidence of it, there is evidence that that didn't happen. And there is no real defense of it when Sean Spicer, the new White House press secretary, was asked about it yesterday. He didn't really defend what President Trump said. He just said the president believes he has evidence of it.
Right. That this is what he believes. I mean, Ross, in this country, the electoral votes count. But nonetheless, this seems to really rankle President Trump.
Well, you know, much of President Trump's language in the course of both the primary and the general election was about winning. And clearly, he sees the Electoral College win almost as a technicality, that it isn't a true win by his standards unless he also wins the popular vote. That, you know, that the Electoral College is kind of a constitutional quirk, a kind of archaic provision, whereas the popular vote is something that everybody understands. And perhaps the public doesn't fully reckon with the magnitude of his victory, if it's only in the Electoral College, and this is a major distraction for him, And I don't know what possible evidence could be adduced that would satisfy him that the Electoral College win was sufficient. He was inaugurated. There's nobody who can take the office away from him because he didn't win the popular vote. But I think this underscores his insecurity.
Sort of like TV ratings. I mean, we don't have the Electoral College deciding on TV ratings. It's about popularity.
That's right. Exactly. And so in a sense, you know, the kind of the referendum part of the election, he lost. And I guess he is painfully aware of that. And the only explanation for it, given his consistent record of winning, is that there is some kind of foul play involved. In this case, some 3 million illegal aliens, I believe he's identified as the illegal voters. Whereas throughout the country, surveys have been taken. Pippa Norris, who runs an election honesty survey at Harvard, said, you know, kind of fragments here and there, mostly people who died or people who've moved. And there wasn't really any conscious effort to masquerade as a voter when you weren't qualified to vote.
Isaac, I know the president of Mexico is coming and will be visiting with President Trump. I also see a tweet by former President Vicente Fox, who says to Trump, grow up, behave like a president, stop lying and cheating the American people. You know you lost the popular vote. So strange to have a former president of a country kind of goading the president of the United States about a vote.
Vicente Fox has been taking shots at Trump for quite a while on Twitter and others. The video he put out at one point of him putting up his middle finger at Trump. So, you know, it is strange. It's not new from Vicente Fox. It's still strange that every time that it happens, it should be noted how strange it is.
And that's Edward Isaac Dover, chief Washington correspondent for Politico, also talking with Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University, and has spent a fair amount of time in the U.S. Congress, especially with Democrats, talking about, I guess, the sausage making of legislation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to get some callers in. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'll read some of those comments, but first let's get John from Philadelphia to join us. And John, go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have John? Yes. Go ahead, John. You are on the air.
Really glad we're discussing the election. One thing that I haven't heard a lot about was the interstate cross-check, where the several state attorney generals got together and compared voting rolls to try to remove people who were, quote, cross state voting lines to vote. There's been an interesting piece by Jeff Pallas covering this, a Rolling Stone journalist. And then I believe the program was put together by a gentleman's name is Chris. He's from Kansas, and he's actually going to be in Trump's cabinet.
And what was their conclusion, John?
Well, the conclusion is that many people were removed from the voting rolls and issued provisional ballots. Now, I do think the provisional ballot system is a good idea for people to be able to vote, but not everybody knows how to follow up on that. Not everybody knows that you're going to need to go into your local office to re-register to vote, essentially. And by clearing people off of the rolls, we've likely had an effect to the electorate. Some of the estimates have been in, you know, like hundreds of thousands of people within individual states where they were issued a provisional ballot, and that ballot may not have been counted because it's only provisional until you follow up with it.
The way our
media covers the race, you know, you think you wouldn't necessarily follow up on a ballot if you don't think it's going to be counted.
I hear you. No, I appreciate John, and we have done many, many shows about how we elect not just presidents, but elect all of our representatives. And there clearly are some holes and potential problems in the system. Let me read a couple of comments here. How is the environment and health of our country protected by these orders? The American public wants to be healthier. Trump should pay for the wall himself and then get Mexico to refund the cost to him. Where can the public protest the gag order to call the White House matter. Always call your representative. I mean, I don't. There's no reason not to do that if you disagree with what your government is doing. Pruitt, as governor of Oklahoma, reduced the EPA budget in the state to zero. Oklahoma has, on average, 3 earthquakes per day as a result of fracking. So clearly, a lot of concerns, a lot of criticism of where people think the presidency, the administration is going. Let me turn back to you, Isaac, and what is on the docket for this week? I mean, today seems like, as President Trump called it, a day of national security. We talked a little bit about the Mexican border wall. There's some questions about refugees, Guantanamo. What can you fill us in on?
So the president is headed to the Department of Homeland Security and to use that as the backdrop for signing a number of new executive actions. One of them is about the construction of the border wall. We'll also cover some information about the number of border agents that are there. We'll also, it's not clear whether it's going to be today. It might be tomorrow, an executive order that seems like it's going to limit immigration from certain countries. Notably, those countries are all countries that are Muslim countries, including Iran, Iraq, Somalia, Libya, and a few others, and Syria. There are restrictions being put on refugee entry, all these sorts of things that were very much themes of the Trump campaign. And I think that one of the things that we are seeing for those people who did not believe it during the campaign or since he won, that a lot of what Donald Trump said as a candidate he would do as president are things that as president he is en route to doing.
Elections have consequences, Ross Baker.
Yes, they certainly do. And I think that on the subject of illegal immigration, the president has sent mixed signals. He certainly is on record as wanting to do away with the protections offered to the so-called dreamers, the people who arrived here as children who have no legal status. Then again, he turned around and talked to Dick Durbin, the Democratic whip, and said, well, we're going to, be kind to these folks. So he's got to redeem the pledges. I think the real engine of intensity among Trump supporters was the immigration issue. And I think that's the one he really has to make good on in terms of the expectations of the people who voted for him. And certainly in terms of the conservative media, they're very much on his case on this particular issue and really are afraid that he might go all moderate on them. So I think for the most part, I think he is going to carry through and come up with some pretty tough positions on immigration and on the status of the people here in the United States illegally.
Isaac, I thought it was interesting that Senator Bernie Sanders was very happy. As you mentioned, it's not like the U.S. had signed TPP, but that he was not going to pursue it. And Senator Sanders gave him a bit of a shout out.
Sure. On this issue, they agree. And I think that it may be the very rare issue in which you'll see Bernie Sanders agreeing with Donald Trump about almost anything.
Let me get Jerry from Roxborough to join our conversation. And Jerry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
I work for a multinational corporation. If someone were to call me from the press and ask for a comment, I would not comment. I would refer it up the line. Companies like Boeing may have one or two spokespersons who are allowed to talk to the press. So I think Trump is approaching this from a business standpoint, where you have to be careful what you say about insider trading or the image. And I think that he's trying to translate this into government. That may not work very well, but I do understand the model. It's a business model. It's not a government model.
Well, that's an interesting comment, Jerry. I appreciate the call. And Ross, does that work in government? I mean, government, there's a constitution that the members of government have to abide by.
Well, you know, I think that something that Edward said earlier, I think, is relevant here, and that is that if you're, you know, forbidden to speak in your official capacity to a journalist, there's always the leak, which is very hard to trace, that journalists protect the people who leak them information. So, you know, you just kind of plug one hole and it comes out another. And I think it's naive for them to think that somehow they are going to button up these bureaucrats to the point where they're totally voiceless. And I just don't think that that's realistic.
And Isaac, we know that President Obama went after a bunch of leakers.
He did. That's right. And
Isaac, go ahead. Sorry.
He did, and that was a something that. One of the people who was involved in that, James Reason, he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times a couple weeks ago saying, if you are uncomfortable with what might happen under Trump, it's leaks, blame Barack Obama. There is a precedent for going after whistleblowers. It does seem like maybe we're into new territory here with what the restrictions are that are so far come out of the Trump White House. I think it's notable two things here. First of all, the restrictions are not going across the government. They're going to targeted agencies that, as we were saying before, are agencies where a lot of change is going to be happening and that are ones that are more caught up in some of the scientific data than that contradicts things that Donald Trump has said politically. And number two, the difference between a private company and the government is that a private company has its owners or shareholders, and the government, the owners and shareholders are all of the American citizens. And so there is a way of running things maybe more in a business-like way, but there are there is a reason why business and government are different kinds of entities. And so the approach that that we have learned to have in our open democracy to expecting an open and public government on a lot of things is one that I think a lot of us should think is a big feature of our democracy.
Well, Edward Isaac Dovere, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Chief Washington correspondent for Politico, Ross Baker, as always, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks very much, Marty.
You're very welcome. Nice to talk to you as well. Political science professor at Rutgers University. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
I could actually run my business and run government at the same time. I don't like the way that looks, but I would be able to do that if I wanted to. I'd be the only one that would be able to do that. You can't do that in any other capacity. But as a president, I could run the Trump Organization. Great, great company, and I could run the company, the country. I'd do a very good job, but I don't want to do that.
That was Donald Trump speaking at a press conference earlier this month. He has handed over control of the Trump Organization to his two sons, but that has not mollified his critics who charge conflict of interest. A group has filed a lawsuit saying that President Trump's hotel in Washington, D.C. violates the U.S. Constitution because it gets money from foreign governments. His company, of course, has done business all over the world. We asked Jim Zeroli to join us. He covers business and economics for NPR. And Jim Zeroli, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Earlier this this week, actually, you reported on a ProPublica story that Donald Trump has not severed his ties with his businesses. And they did a pretty deep dive, talked to a bunch of states where companies are registered, including Delaware, of course. Has anything changed in the last couple of days? Has he in any way severed ties with any of these companies?
Yeah, well, the ProPublica story said that as of Friday afternoon, I think at like 3:15, they had called some of the states where he does business, and that they hadn't seen any sign that he had actually relinquished control of his companies. Now, since then, there have been some documents filed in some places. Changing ownership, taking Trump's name off of the companies. In other words, he's no longer the president. He's replaced it with his son's name, Eric's name. So they have begun to take some steps to do that. Now, I think most people who are concerned about this issue would say that doesn't begin to go, you know, to do enough to address this issue. I mean, there aren't signs, for instance, that he's given up ownership of the companies, right, or even, you know, given ownership to his children. and even that probably wouldn't go far enough.
Is it, to mollify his critics, many of whom are government ethicists, is it either sell your organization or put it in a truly blind trust? Would that deal with some of the ethical concerns?
Yeah, I think both of those actually he would have to do. I think some of the people who have been bringing this issue out into the public the most say what they say is, you know, Trump has all of these businesses, all of these subsidiary companies all over the world. What he has to do, it really is sell them all and take the proceeds, whatever he makes, and put that in a blind trust and say to some independent person here, you invest this, you take care of this. I'm not even going to know what you're doing, which is what other presidents have done. Now, the problem with Trump is he's got so many more assets and so many more companies, so many more real estate properties all over the world, really, that it would be much more complicated for him to do that. But I think the ethics experts say, you know, if you really want to be clean, if you want to remove a doubt, if you want to put this issue behind you, that's what you have to do.
Well, we heard in that clip that he's saying that a president actually doesn't have to do this. And I guess other presidents who are not nearly as wealthy or have as many business ties have essentially done what the ethicists say that they should do. But this is really an honor system, is it not, Jim?
Well, what he says is, and he's right about this, the federal statute that applies to conflict of interest, it says, you know, if you're in the executive branch, if you're a cabinet secretary or a deputy or assistant cabinet secretary, you know, anybody, you can't profit from the work you do. Mm-hmm. You can't profit from your position. That's a conflict of interest. But it exempts the president and the vice president. So when Trump says that, he is technically right within the law. Now, the critics would come back and say, you know, there are other things that will require him to sell his properties. For instance, the emoluments clause of the Constitution.
Something we've all just learned, right?
Right,
that word, emoluments.
Right. Yeah. I thought it was some kind of skin cream or something. But. They say, you know, there are other things he has to worry about. For, you know, presidents aren't allowed to take bribes, for instance. And, you know, you get in these situations where – and this is really the essence of the problem. He's president, but he's also got all these businesses. He continues to own them. He continues, you know, to profit from them. If somebody from a foreign country, for instance, if his sons go to a government and to talk about putting up a hotel someplace, they're going to need government permission to do various things. That government is going to, you know, are they going to want to say no to the president of the United States or his family? So there's this question about, you know, even if a president is acting in good faith, the mere fact that, he's profiting from these decisions is a problem. It causes, it's sort of an erosion of confidence in the public about what he's doing, and that's a bad thing for the government.
From that press conference that he had earlier this month, there was this gigantic pile of papers and documents mm-hmm. that he pointed to, and his lawyer pointed to. Jim, does anyone know what were in those
no.
pieces of paper? Did anyone have a chance to look at them?
No one did. It was a sort of a big stack of manila envelopes and was sitting next to him at the press conference. And he said these documents are proof that I have done what I said I was going to do, that I'm surrendering control. And this is going to happen by Inauguration Day. And they didn't release those to the public.
Well, let's talk about then the Trump Hotel that's at the old post office in Washington, D.C., relatively newly open. Now, my understanding is that the building is owned by the GSA. What questions does that raise?
Well, that has actually been one of the most problematic of his business ventures. It's the building itself is owned by the federal government, and he bid, he outbid other hotel other companies, and won the lease to use that space. It's an old, you know, elaborate old post office building to put a hotel in there. Now the GSA lease says something along the lines of, you know, an elected official can't be added to this lease. And of course, Trump is an elected official now. So a lot of people have raised the question, you know, is this a violation of the lease? Now, the larger question here is what can really be done about it, because you know, there's a question of who has legal standing to challenge this. It would have to be the GSA. And it's not clear the GSA is going to want to do that, since Trump actually presides over the GSA. He's the head of the federal government. But there's another question, which is you're seeing this situation now where foreign governments, diplomats begin to use that hotel. You know, when a country decides to have a reception there, for instance, are they doing it because that's the best hotel for them? Or are they doing it because they want to curry favor with the president? We don't know. We can't really know for sure. And at any rate, you have this situation where the president is making money, you know, potentially because of the position that he holds. And leaving aside the lease and the legal questions, I mean, that just bothers people.
Well, is the argument that if a foreign business or government goes to the Trump Hotel in Washington, they pay for their room, that could be seen as an emolument?
Yeah, that is, or, you know, if they rent a reception space in the hotel, you know, is that an emolument? And that's also, you know, there's this question of legal standing over the case. But there's also a question of, you know, is that an emolument? Is the Trump people would say, well, that's just a fair market transaction. It's not a gift. You know, they're not just giving money to Donald Trump so he can spend it himself. They're renting a hotel room, and the money's going to a corporation that he's a big shareholder of, or, you know, privately controls. And, you know, that's a problem.
Let me read an email from Margaret. Says, how can he possibly get away with hiding his tax returns, especially after all his accusations against President Obama, birth certificate, and Secretary Clinton, emails, connections with the Clinton Foundation, etc.? But she raises a question about his tax returns. Now, he, as my memory serves me, he said, you know, once this audit is over, he would release his tax returns. That's when he was running for president. And more recently, it's not going to happen. Where does that stand, Jim?
Well, yeah, he said that repeatedly. He said, I'm under audit. I can't release them. Now, he said, I think the argument was his lawyers didn't want him to release them. And that is, you know, I've talked to lawyers who say that's very reasonable on the part of his lawyers. You know, they would tell him, you can't release these publicly while the audit is going on. That makes sense. But Trump did say repeatedly, during the campaign, he said, when the audit is finished, I will release them. Now, it has to be said that he's been audited a lot over the years. So there's a question of when is the audit ever really finished. But he did say that. And now this weekend, Kellyanne Conway was on TV, and she basically said, no, we're not going to release them. Right. We think this has been litigated in the campaign, and he doesn't have to do it. And she was pretty firm about that, just sort of seemed to shut the door on this. So, I there's a question now, are we ever really going to see the tax returns?
I saw a poll, one from ABC, 70% of at least those polls wanted Trump to release his tax return. Pew, 60%. So clearly a majority of the public is interested in knowing about Donald Trump's taxes. Now, Jim, a group has filed a lawsuit earlier this week. Who are they, and what do they want?
Yeah, this is Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, and they were joined by, you know, some well-known constitutional scholars like Lawrence Tribe of Harvard Law School, and they said his continuing to own these properties is a violation of the Emoluments Clause, and they asked the federal court to tell him he could no longer do that. So that suit was filed. There's a question of where it's going to go. Does this group, you know, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, is, you know, they're an advocacy group. They advocate for good government. And their argument was something like, we are an ethics watchdog. And because of the president's conflicts, we have to put a lot of our time and energy and staff into bringing this out, publicizing this, talking to the press. Therefore, we have an interest in this. Now, they did that because they have to establish that they have some kind of legal standing to file a suit like this. There's a question of whether they really do, whether that's going to hold up in court. I don't know. But they have to go through some hurdles before this they can win this case.
I do want to get some callers on, but just a quick follow-up here. Does Congress have any power to force either the release of tax returns or to get him to sell the Trump Hotel or some of these issues we've been talking about?
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, of course, the question is just, are they going to do that? Would they do that? It's a Republican Congress, and they're not, you know, while a lot of them, I'm sure, have reservations about President Trump, are they going to want to take this issue up? I mean, you have to ask. I mean, you said there's a poll that says people think that Trump should release his tax returns. I'm sure people do say that when they're asked by pollsters. I wonder how much of a priority it really is for people.
Sure.
A lot of people voted for him anyway.
Absolutely. Let me get Matt from Doylestown to join our conversation. And Matt, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Just two comments. You know, these ethics groups seem a little bit arbitrary. I don't see that. I remember them out there talking about, people who lobby for foreign interests after they leave administrations, people whose kids, wives, girlfriends, all the multitude of different connected interrelations there are in D.C. It's a town of special interest, and everything is influenced because people have skin in the game at some level. So, I mean, there's many other areas they could be concentrating on ethics-wise. This is just the red meat of the day. Secondly, as far as the hotel stays and things like that, I recall President Trump saying that the profits of any hotel stay would contribute back to the American people. So I, for one, hope that every foreign dignitary stays at a Trump hotel so that the profits are donated back to the U.S. people. There's nothing wrong with that. That's good business. And if that actually brings profit back to American people, so be it.
Well, fair enough, Matt. And I do believe Jim Zarroli, he did say something very close to that. And I guess what Matt is saying is, what's wrong with that?
Well, nothing's wrong with that. I would say two things. One, that wouldn't really begin to address all the problems, all the conflicts that he has. And two, because it's a privately held company and he hasn't released his tax returns, we won't know whether he's actually done that. We'll have no way of knowing.
And I guess there are questions about, I'm not a business person, clearly, about what is considered profit and what is not considered profit.
Sure. Yeah, I think I'm not sure, but I think he said he would, any profit from this stay would be donated to the people, something like that. I don't remember.
So, Jim, as you look ahead, we're almost out of time here. What issues are you following? I know you cover business and economics for NPR, but is there something in particular you're looking at?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty much all on this issue all the time of conflicts of interest. I don't know how long it will go on. But that's what I'm doing for now. All conflicts all the time.
and what would settle a conflict of interest either way would be some kind of a court decision?
Yeah, I mean, you could have a court decision that would do that, or you could have Congress step in and do it. That seems to be a long way off at this point. And of course, if there's enough public outcry, I guess Trump could be forced to do more, but he hasn't done that yet.
Jim Zarroli, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're welcome.
And he covers business and economics for NPR, joined us from the studios of NPR. That's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, listen to us on satellite radio, and all that good stuff. I'm Marty Moscone. Thanks for joining us.